Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to As It Is. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We are here 7 days a week to help you learn and improve your American English. We do this by speaking a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Each day we bring you news and information about important things that are happening around the world. Today we begin with China. The country's leaders say they support international efforts to defeat terrorism. But it seems they also include actions against those who China believes are religious extremists in Xinjiang. We will tell you more. Then we will turn our attention to Vietnam, where police are accused of harming some people they have arrested. Two very important stories are coming to you from VOA, Washington. The government in China says it supports international efforts to defeat terrorism. The statement comes as the United States military attacks targets of the Islamic State militant group in Syria. Increasingly, China is seeing the fight against the Islamic State as an extension of its own efforts against people it considers religious extremists in Xinjiang. Jonathan Evans has more on the story.
China is unlikely to give the United States or other countries help in fighting the Islamic State forces anytime soon. But the Chinese government does believe that the fight against the militants is similar to its own efforts to deal with growing unrest at home. Hua Chunying is with China's foreign ministry. Ms. Hua says that China has repeatedly made its opposition to terrorism clear, in all shapes and forms. In her words, the international community should work together to fight terrorism, including giving support to relevant countries as they make efforts to maintain domestic security and stability. Some observers have questioned China's battle against what it says are violent religious extremists. Over the past year, attacks in China have increasingly targeted innocent civilians. Most of those attacks took place in Xinjiang. However, the root causes of the incidents are sharply disputed, and the government severely limits information about what happened. Overseas Uyghur groups have criticized the government. They say its repressive religious and cultural policies in Xinjiang are fueling tensions. Inside China, individuals who question government policies in Xinjiang are silenced, sometimes in court. On Tuesday, the Chinese government sentenced Ilham Tohti, an expert on Uyghurs, to life in prison on separatism charges. He had long been seen as someone who tried to ease tensions between China's ethnic Han majority and the Uyghur Muslim minority in Xinjiang. The United States, European Union, and the United Nations have called for his release. The court sentence and other policies against Uyghurs are expected to make it more difficult for China to win international support for its fight at home. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. Vietnam has rejected a report that accuses Vietnamese police of abusing detainees. Vietnam's foreign ministry says the country has a firm commitment against all forms of torture or cruel treatments. A foreign ministry official noted that Vietnamese laws require strict punishment for those involved in abuse. The comments were in reaction to a report from the group Human Rights Watch. Christopher Cruz has more on the story.
Human Rights Watch expressed concern about abuses by Vietnamese police. It noted an increase in reports of torture and deaths of individuals in police detention, especially in rural areas of the country. The group released a report on the subject. Almost 2 years ago, Vietnamese police detained Nguyen Thanh Thang and his friend Pham Quoc Nhat in Dong Thap province. Police suspected the two were robbers and took them to the local police headquarters. Pham Quoc Nhat says that at the police station, they were both beaten severely on their arms and legs. He says the next day, he could no longer hear the shouts of his friend. Nguyen Thanh Thang died in detention before police took him to a hospital. Human Rights Watch says the incident is just one example of widespread abuse of Vietnamese citizens while in police detention. The report describes 28 cases of people who died while they were being held by police. Some of the deaths reportedly resulted from suicide. Others were from sickness or disease. The group also describes 22 cases of severe beatings, including that of an 11-year-old boy. Phil Robertson is the Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. He says many Vietnamese have complained about abuse of detainees by police.
This is a report about farmers and businessmen, local merchants, students, and others who ended up in police custody for activities that you and I would not consider to be out of the ordinary. And in fact, where laws were broken, these were invariably minor infractions. Yet these people ended up dead or injured from beatings inflicted on them by police while they were being held in police custody.
The new report is based partly on information from government-controlled Vietnamese language newspapers. Human Rights Watch also used information from independent bloggers, citizen reporters, and foreign news media. The group says deaths often resulted when police used violence or torture to force people to admit to crimes. It said police were often accused of abuse, but were either not punished or were given light punishment. The rights group is calling for reforms, more openness about abuse accusations, and information about those being held in police detention. It also wants independent investigations of all accusations of police violence. But officials in Vietnam say they are taking steps to deal with the problem. Chan Dai Quan is the country's Minister for Public Security. Earlier this month, he spoke about the reports of abuse to a committee of Vietnam's National Assembly. He said 19 police officers had been punished. He said they could be charged with crimes because of abuses. The Ministry of Public Security also said that it had punished police involved in 183 cases over the past 3 years. Some of the officers were given light punishment. Others were removed from the police force or sent to other areas. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for listening. We hope you learned something important and improved your American English at the same time. We urge you to print the words we say and download the audio as a podcast. Then practice reading and speaking English every chance you have. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is program. Goodbye for now.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. The school year has begun in Cameroon, but thousands of students and teachers are fleeing their schools in towns that border Nigeria's Borno State. The state is the home of the Boko Haram terrorist group. 1,000 children were expected to start classes in government schools in the border town of Kolofata, but only a few arrived. 17-year-old Foncha Renee was one of those who did come to school. He says Boko Haram attacks in the area have frightened away other students. Recent armed conflict between the Nigerian Boko Haram rebels and Cameroon soldiers collapsed the school walls. Pamela Singeth works at the government school in Kolofata. She spoke to VOA while taking refuge in a military camp.
I cannot advise any child to go to school in a border zone because it is dangerous. Look at some classrooms that have been destroyed by Boko Haram. They even come here to pray. So I will not allow or advise any child to go to school in this area.
Like Kolofata, Mora is also a town on the border with Borno State. 700 students were expected at school there, but only 100 students appeared. And those who arrived found more than 2,000 Nigerian refugees in their school building. Babila Akao serves as administrative official for the area. He says, "People are suffering. The situation is a bad situation." He says he is asking the Ministry of Education to postpone the start of the school year. Kolofata and Mora are just two of the 25 schools on the border with Nigeria's Borno State. Monuna Fatso is Cameroon's Secretary of State of the Ministry of Secondary Education. He says the government plans to move students from local schools for security reasons. He says at that time, the government will bring the teachers and the students to the new sites. He says the goal of Boko Haram is to traumatize the citizens. Over time, Cameroon has worked to extend and improve its educational system. 14 years ago, the government began providing free education. The action was part of efforts to increase school attendance. Cameroon is also trying to educate all the youngest school-age children. Boko Haram is a threat to Cameroon students and educational goals. The group has killed, kidnapped, and stolen from villages along the 2,000-kilometer border with Nigeria. The group has gained energy and strength in its fight to establish a government ruled by a religious leader and Sharia Islamic law in northern Nigeria. Cameroonian and Nigerian military action has failed to stop the violence. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Jerry Watson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Just before sunrise on April 12, 1861, the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. A heavy mortar roared, sending a shell high over the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina. The shell dropped and exploded above Fort Sumter, a United States military base on an island in the harbor. The explosion was a signal for all Confederate guns surrounding the fort to open fire. Shell after shell smashed into the fort. The booming of the cannons woke the people of Charleston. They rushed to the harbor and cheered as the bursting shells lighted the dark sky. This week in our series, Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer tell about the attack on Fort Sumter.
Confederate leaders ordered the attack after President Abraham Lincoln refused to withdraw the small force of American soldiers at Sumter. Food supplies at the fort were very low, and Southerners expected hunger would force the soldiers to leave. But Lincoln announced he was sending a ship to Fort Sumter with food. Confederate President Jefferson Davis ordered his commander in Charleston, General Beauregard, to destroy the fort before the food could arrive.
The attack started from Fort Johnson, across the harbor from Sumter. A Virginia congressman, Roger Pryor, was visiting Fort Johnson when the order to fire was given. The fort's commander asked Pryor if he would like the honor of firing the mortar that would begin the attack. "No," answered Pryor, and his voice shook. "I cannot fire the first gun of the war." But others could, and the attack began.
At Fort Sumter, Major Robert Anderson and his men waited 3 hours before firing back at the Confederate guns. Anderson could not use his most powerful cannons. They were in the open, at the top of the fort, where there was no protection for the gunners. Too many of his small force would be lost if he tried to fire these guns. So Anderson had his men fire the smaller cannon from better protected positions. These, however, did not do much damage to the Confederate guns.
The shelling continued all day. A big cloud of smoke rose high in the air over Fort Sumter. The smoke was seen by United States Navy ships a few miles outside Charleston Harbor. They had come with the ship bringing food for the men at Sumter. There were soldiers on these ships, but they could not reach the fort to help Major Anderson. Confederate boats blocked the entrance to the harbor, and Confederate guns could destroy any ship that tried to enter. The commander of the naval force, Captain Fox, had hoped to move the soldiers to Sumter in small boats, but the sea was so rough that the small boats could not be used. Fox could only watch and hope for calmer seas.
Confederate shells continued to smash into Sumter throughout the night and into the morning of the second day. The fires at Fort Sumter burned higher, and smoke filled the rooms where soldiers still tried to fire their cannons. About noon, three men arrived at the fort in a small boat. One of them was Lewis Wigfall, a former United States senator from Texas, now a Confederate officer. He asked to see Major Anderson. "I come from General Beauregard," he said. "It is time to put a stop to this, sir. The flames are raging all around you, and you have defended your flag bravely. Will you leave, sir?" Wigfall asked.
Major Anderson was ready to stop fighting. His men had done all that could be expected of them. They had fought well against a much stronger enemy. Anderson said he would surrender if he and his men could leave with honor. Wigfall agreed. He told Anderson to lower his flag and the firing would stop. Down came the United States flag, and up went the white flag of surrender. The battle of Fort Sumter was over. More than 4,000 shells had been fired during the 33 hours of fighting, but no one on either side was killed. One United States soldier, however, was killed the next day when a cannon exploded as Anderson's men prepared to leave the fort.
The news of Anderson's surrender reached Washington late Saturday, April 13th. President Lincoln and his cabinet met the next day and wrote a declaration that the president would announce on Monday. In it, Lincoln said powerful forces had seized control in 7 states of the South. He said these forces were too strong to be stopped by courts or policemen. Lincoln said troops were needed. He requested that the states send him 75,000 soldiers. He said these men would be used to get control of forts and other federal property seized from the Union.
Lincoln knew he had the support of his own party. He also wanted Northern Democrats to give him full support. So, Sunday evening, a Republican congressman visited the top Democrat of the North, Senator Stephen Douglas. The congressman urged Douglas to go to the White House and tell Lincoln that he would do all he could to help put down the rebellion in the South. At first, Douglas refused. He said Lincoln had removed Democrats, friends of his, from government jobs, and had given the jobs to Republicans. Douglas said he didn't like this. Anyway, he said, Lincoln probably did not want his advice. The congressman, George Ashman, urged Douglas to forget party politics. He said Lincoln and the country needed the senator's help. Douglas finally agreed to talk with Lincoln. He and Ashman went immediately to the White House.
Lincoln welcomed his old political opponent. He explained his plans and read to Douglas the declaration he would announce the next day. Douglas said he agreed with every word of it, except, he said, 75,000 soldiers would not be enough. Remembering his problems with Southern extremists, he urged Lincoln to ask for 200,000 men. He told the president, "You do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as well as I do." Lincoln and Douglas talked for 2 hours. Then the senator gave a statement for the newspapers. He said he still opposed the administration on political questions, but, he said, he completely supported Lincoln's efforts to protect the Union. Douglas was to live for only a few more months. He spent this time working for the Union. He traveled through the states of the Northwest, making many speeches. Douglas urged Democrats everywhere to support the Republican government. He told them, "There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors."
Throughout the North, thousands of men rushed to answer Lincoln's call for troops. Within 2 days, a military group from Boston left for Washington. Other groups formed quickly in northern cities and began training for war. Lincoln received a different answer, however, from the border states between North and South. Virginia's governor said he would not send troops to help the North get control of the South. North Carolina's governor said the request violated the Constitution. He would have no part of it. Tennessee said it would not send one man to help force Southern states back into the Union. But it said it would send 50,000 troops to defend Southern rights. Lincoln got the same answer from the governors of Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. For several days, it seemed that all these states would secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
Lincoln worried most about Virginia, the powerful state just across the Potomac River from Washington. A secession convention already was meeting at the state capitol. On April 17th, the convention voted to take Virginia out of the Union. Virginia's vote to secede forced an American Army officer to make a most difficult decision. The officer was Colonel Robert E. Lee, a citizen of Virginia. The Army's top commander, General Winfield Scott, had called Lee to Washington. Scott believed Lee was the best officer in the Army. Lincoln agreed. He asked Lee to take General Scott's job to become the Army chief. Lee was offered the job on the same day that Virginia left the Union.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts are online, along with historical pictures, at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our programs at twitter.com/voalearnenglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.